You're listening to the Tech Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour, we will be talking about all things tech. I'm joined by my fellow presenter, Sarah Luxford of Tech London Advocates. Hello there.
Hello. Good afternoon, Sue. How are you?
You're already with your New Year's resolutions. 2018 is going to be the one for you, is it?
Absolutely. I'm determined this year to make a stellar impact.
Stellar impact?
A stellar impact. Well, a wide range of things, actually. Basically, from spiritual, I need to take a bit more care of that side, as well as ensuring that I read a book over the New Year's called How to Get Your S Beep Together. And indeed, that's what I'm going to be doing during 2018. And I'm just having a look at my yoga tea here. It says, the art of happiness is to serve all.
Just look after yourself is what I'm doing for 2019. Now, we've got we've got three lovely guests in the studio today. So first of all, we have Tamara Lawn, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Hi, Tamara.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, that's all right. Can't wait to talk about your stuff. Can't afford to stay in one of your hotels, so I just need to listen about it. Have you stayed in one?
Not yet. I will soon.
Excellent. And we have Robert Simpson of Slick Revolution. Hi, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
Good. You've brought in a lovely funky skateboard for us to have a look at later, I believe.
That's right, yeah, an electric skateboard.
I'm going to hear all about that. And then we have Dr. Alexander Enoch, who actually prefers to be called Sandy Enoch, Robotical.
Yep.
And you've got a robot that we've been looking at. So we've got some exciting things to go on to here today. So I'm actually going to start with you, Sandy, actually. Now, you've got a robot in front of you, which I can describe. It's blue and yellow, and I would say it's about... just under, what I'd say, about 20, 25 centimetres tall. It looks very friendly. It's got big white eyes and it's got a moustache. And that's about it, really. Now, tell me a little bit about the company that actually you've started that make this robot, and then we'll go on and explain what the robot actually does.
But okay.
You started the company.
Yep, so I started Robotical. We officially incorporated back at the start of 2016, but I've been working on it for about a year and a bit before then. So I had the concept that I wanted to sort of get into educational robotics back in 2015. And I'd been working on a robotics PhD, making walking robots. And,
of course you have.
Yep. I've been kind of a robot guy for quite a while. So, but it's an amazing field to be in right now. It's very exciting. And... particularly, we need to get more people into technology and more people into programming. So I was looking into how I could make a little walking robot that was accessible, sort of affordable, but it was still a real robot. So I wanted to make a sort of proper little two-legged walking robot.
Explain to me exactly what a robot is. You know, what is the definition of a robot? Because it doesn't have to look like a person, does it?
Not at all. So that's a very difficult question.
I'm just looking here. You have a master's degree in robotics. So I assume you knew what it was.
Yeah, well. I mean, it's one of those words. So it comes originally a Czech word. There was a play by Karel Čapek. Basically, it means worker. In that sort of original derivation. If you ask most people what a robot is, they'll think of something that sort of moves physically in the real world. Yeah. And most people working in robotics tend to sort of think that a robot has to be something that senses and that actually interacts in a way. So your washing machine probably, is that a robot? Well, maybe. It's sort of sensing, you know, if it's just doing a sort of program, maybe it's not. But maybe if it could unload itself, then it would be a robot. And a remote control car is probably not a robot. But if you've got one that you can program to say, well, drive around and solve a maze, then that becomes a robot. So I think most people these days would say that it has to be something that, that can move around and have some sense of interactivity.
Can do something, all by itself.
Yeah.
Now, your robot that you've got there is fully programmable. I can't even say that word. Programmable. Help me there, Sarah. Wi-Fi enabled, customizable and upgradable and low cost. So why were you really keen to get something that was accessible?
Well, I mean, as I said, we need to get more people sort of involved with technology. And so all the sort of real robots, especially the walking ones that you can get, they're really quite expensive. So I wanted to make one that was actually sort of usable up to university level. So there's a proper little robot hidden under the sort of friendly exterior, but that was the price of a smart toy, so one that anybody can sort of get. And that's where the sort of upgradability and customizability comes in. So we embrace sort of 3D printing. You can make your own parts if you want to. You can upgrade it with a little Raspberry Pi computer if you want to. But it's very important to me to make something that was available to sort of everyone, because we're all about inspiring engineers and sort of facilitating them. And it's difficult to do that if nobody can afford your stuff.
So you've got Raspberry Pi, haven't you, at home?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to just explain a little bit about what it is?
No.
Okay.
No, yeah. essentially, it's a board within which you can then program certain actions, and it feeds into a computer, things into a device, and from there, magical things can happen.
But the point of that is allowing children, in particular, not just children, of course, to start to understand how to program and start to get that connection.
Very much so. It's usually, or has been, the choice for schools to help children learn how to code in the first instance. Just out of interest, with this, you said about it being available for all and pricing, etc. So how much would a Marty robot cost?
So they're retailing for £150, which is about the same price as sort of your average smart toy. if you are more makery, though, you can print one out yourself, 3D print it, and we can just sell you the electronics inside it for a lower cost. But yeah, we tried to be sort of, cheaper than a sort of Lego Mindstorms kit or something like that.
See, so we've got Marty in front of us. Now, Marty helps us learn about programming, electronics, mechanical engineering. Can you demonstrate stuff now? I'm gonna.
Yeah, I should
say. So I say he's blue and yellow. He's got these big, huge eyes. And now what you're doing is you've got your phone. We've got Marty in front of us. What are you telling Marty to do right at this minute in time?
Well,
his eyes are moving.
Expressive eyebrows. So basically we're trying to do a bit of a progression with Marty. So you can start off just by remote controlling, and then we try and get you to move into programming. So I could, for example, just remote control him here, and you can maybe hear the motors whirring away in the background.
So you can hear the motors whirring in the background. So Marty now is moving from leg to leg. He dances better than I do, that's for sure.
Yeah, he's a very unique way of walking. That's the sort of
It's almost like a penguin. He's walking like a penguin.
A little waddle, yeah. Like to say, he's got swagger. But so that's the sort of unique bit. So Marty, no other robots walk quite like Marty walks. And that sort of is one of the things that makes us a bit more affordable. So yeah, he can sort of walk around, and he can sort of turn, and he can...
So Marty's now looking at me. Oh, he's just done a sort of... You know the thing when you've got a hula hoop? He's just done a sort of wiggle like that. His eyebrows are moving up and down. And that's all guided by your phone.
So that was all on the phone, yeah.
So anybody who's suddenly got... Marty's now dancing. If anybody's got a phone and whatever, that's how they'd start, wouldn't it? By working out.
So
if I do
this
on my phone, that then makes this robot do this thing
here.
Yeah,
so Marty comes as a kit that you put together.
Yeah.
So once you've done that, you can sort of just straight away get it to move around.
You get rewarded in a way.
Exactly, yeah. You've made something that works. Well done.
Yeah.
How long would it take to make... Marty the robot, if you were a kid, for example?
We say if you're younger than 14, you probably want an adult to help out with you, to help you out. It takes about 3 or 4 hours to put one together. So that's something we're still tuning, actually, is the difficulty of the build, because we want it to feel like you've achieved something, but not...
It's got to be hard, but not too hard.
Exactly. So that's actually a really tricky thing to do. So we're tuning that in a bit still. This is our second batch of Martys that we've made just now, about to go out the door. But we think we're sort of getting it about there. So it's meant to be a sort of fun evening project. And then you've got, that's your sort of first evening, you build it, and then you should feel far more attached to it because you've actually sort of brought this thing to life.
Absolutely.
And the moustache, by the way, is a sticker. So you have lots of options for different stickers you can put on, and your Marty doesn't have to have a moustache. You can have eyelashes and all kinds of other nice things.
So Marty will have those eyes, but you can make the rest of his face as you wish.
Or her face, if you wish.
Yeah, it's entirely up to you. So in the first instance, you're working it from your phone. Now, you've got your laptop charged up there. What's the sort of next stage after that?
So the next stage is to actually get into programming. So we use a few different languages for Marty, starting with Scratch, which is a graphical language. So you just have blocks that you click and drag around. Developed by MIT, it's great for getting kids from about eight to sort of 12, into programming. And it's a real programming language, even though it looks not what you might expect. And then from there, you can progress on into languages like Python and C++. right the way up to, you can utilize the robot operating system, ROS, which is something we do up at university. So we try and provide this nice progression. But I've got Scratch open here. As an example, I can just show you, I've programmed Marty to do a handshake. So if I run...
Okay, so there we are. You're just... So you've just literally clicked one button on your laptop there.
Yep. So I have a program that I made, one I made earlier, Ingo Blue Peter style. And so you can see it's a list of blocks. And what Marty's doing now is actually waiting for somebody to grab his hand. So if you shake,
okay, so, push down so a little bit. Sandy's just moved Oops. Marty across to Tamara, and Tamara's now shaking Marty's hand. And Marty the robot is really, he's obviously very keen on you, Tamara, isn't he? He's very keen on you. He's very happy about that. He's doing a little dance.
A bit of a wiggle there at the end.
A bit of a wiggle, yeah.
But yeah, so that was actually a simple program where we said to Marty, lift your arm up. And then we were reading the amount of force that was exerted onto the arm. So he's got lots of sensors embodied in him. So you can tell how much each of his joints is working, a bit like how you can tell if somebody bumps into you. So then we're waiting for there to be a certain amount of force on the arm before we shake hands. And so you have to think, how many sort of up and downs do I want to do in a handshake? You don't want to go sort of full Trump. And so there's a lot of these little things. And doing a handshake is actually sort of a recipe. It's a program. You have to sort of break it down into simpler steps. And so we're sort of getting into computational thinking and trying to break down what sounds fairly sort of simple, but actually it's quite a complicated thing. Mm. We have to figure that out.
And Sarah, with your background in women in tech, it's really important to have these types of toys, because when people are much younger, they're not thinking that they can't do, you know, tech things, are they? It doesn't strike them at all if it's just fun. It's not a gender bias thing, is it, at that point?
Technology is not supposed to be biased, as far as I'm concerned, and I don't think it really is. It's just the culture, experiences, and all the other great biases that we then put upon ourselves. But I love Marty simply because it is an opportunity for parents and kids and kids and other kids to come together and build something that's exciting and fun. And whilst you're learning, it's fantastic. Who wouldn't want to have a handshaking, all dancing, hula hooping robot.
Oh, thank you. So,
yeah, it's great. And I love the fact that you've considered the fact that it's not just the moustaches, etc. You're putting in the feminine side of things with the robot too. So that
yeah, and within reason. Options. We didn't want to have just a pink one and make it gendered. So we thought we'll sort of leave the options open. And but yeah, it doesn't have a gender, it's a robot. So
Yeah. But I think what's interesting for me is what I was trying to explain is that you're starting at an age where nobody's concerned about that. It's just really good fun. And that's what it should be like. It's just about being good fun. And what's really interesting with this, I think, is you do a little bit and then you get encouraged and then you want to do the next thing, then you want to do the next thing. And before you know it, you started coding and you hadn't even realised it. And I think it's coding by stealth, I think, Sarah. That's a good idea, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely, coding by stealth. There's a new workshop.
Yeah. Tamara, just you know, having a look at that, what's your thoughts, having never seen something like that before?
I have seen similar, actually. I've got an 11-year-old boy who is very into robotics and coding. And I know Bethany Kobe, who founded Tech Will Save Us as well, and so I've got loads of her products at home. And my son is always wanting to build his own robot. I wish I had come on this program before Christmas. Because that would have been definitely under the tree.
The present. Yeah. And Robert.
But I wish you'd come in with a female one. It would have been nice.
Sorry, I just grabbed one out of the office. So
just grabbed what was closest. You just grabbed what was closest.
Yeah, because my daughter as well, you know, I'd love her to get into this. She's a couple of years behind, but
And it's a good one for all the family as well, actually. So
yes.
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great project. I find putting these things together with my son is just a fantastic project. And I love the way he just gets absorbed by making something. You know, it's just so much better than seeing him on his iPad all the time.
No, Robert, your thoughts on this?
I think it's great. I think about when I was perhaps 9 or 10, I remember having a Furby, which I suppose you could call one of the earlier robots. It'd respond to you tickling its belly, it'd blink, it'd open its mouth, that kind of thing. But I think this is the next step in that it doesn't just respond to your actions, you can create its actions. It's much more interactive, and I think it's great for getting kids on board with being interested in the world around them and how things work, rather than just having it work.
I always wanted to kick one of those Furbies. I didn't really like the look of them much. Do you know, they're really sort of smug, actually.
I thought it'd get a bit annoying after hairy. A while. I had one too,
What I love about this is that you can take it apart, build it. You know, because it feels like we've lost that a little bit, you know, because you would never take your phone apart. You know, we'd let a child take a phone apart or, you know, lo and behold, not a Mac. And, you know, at the early days of computers, you could literally, you know, crowbar them open.
Back with the BBC Micros and your ZX Spectrums and stuff.
Spectrum, that's what I had.
I'm showing their age here. Yeah.
My dad had the Spectrum.
Yes, yeah. I'm far too
young. Those little bars going up and down. Yeah, that's right.
Far too young to know what you're talking about.
I was going to say maker culture. Like, there's a bit of a revolution right now, actually being able to.
Meccano and Lego back again, really.
Yeah, but also just, you know, far more in electronics. So things like Tech Will Save Us and the maker movement and 3D printers and everything. And trying to get across the idea that you can actually fix things and change them and repair them. And so that's one of the reasons Marty is a kit, is because we actually want people to get hands-on with the physicalities of it and realise that you can.
So what's your ambitions? You know, you've got, this is your second version. What's the ambitions for the company and for you in terms of robotics?
Yeah, so we're still in the early days, really. So we shipped our first batch of products just in sort of late summer last year. And then, production's really difficult. So we've got the second batch out now. So it's a case of just trying to refine Marty to the stage where the customer experience, user experience is really sort of smooth and where it's a really good introduction to robotics and a really nice learning platform for as many people as possible. So we want Marty to, in a way, become the Raspberry Pi of robotics, I suppose. So like, if you're thinking of having a teaching tool to help you illustrate the concepts of robotics, you've got something that's useful for sort of primary school levels, but can also be used sort of for more advanced stuff like you can with the Raspberry Pi.
And is it proving popular?
So far, yeah. So, I mean, we've had a great response from the sort of first thing. So we did a crowdfunding campaign with very little marketing budget. But because I think Marty's quite photogenic, it sort of helps. And
it's a visual thing, isn't it?
It's very visual, yeah. I wanted to make something that was quite engaging. So you actually, you want to sort of get it to do things and to wave hello to you and stuff. So that's all been really good. And now we just have to sort of build on that. So we're actually trying to going to gear up our marketing efforts a bit and try and get out there a bit more. And this year, hopefully, get, you know, quite a few thousand Martys away and just keep growing. And and then he'll have some sidekicks in due course.
Well, I'm sold to you, Sarah.
Absolutely. I only wish my nephew was a little bit older and I'd get him one straight away.
What, so that you could play with it?
Yeah, exactly.
Basically. Well, we wish you luck with that. That's very good. So I'm going to turn now to Tamara. So Tamara Lawn,
yes,
of Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So you founded Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Yes,
with your husband. We are going to talk about some tech stuff as well. And for those who don't know, it's a sort of travel club for hotel lovers. Have I got that right?
That's right, yes.
Okay. And having looked at your stuff for ages and ages, because it's been around for a little while, it's very, very stylish.
Oh, great, thank you.
Well, don't you think? I mean, do you think?
It's beautiful. It's absolutely stunning. Every time I pick up a brochure and have a look through, I just think, oh, please, hobby.
We have been called the hotel porn site.
The hotel porn site, yeah.
Well,
it is really. I mean, and, you know, I'm not sure I'm allowed to go on one of most Mr. and Mrs. Smith holidays. So I'm not sure I quite fit your profile, but anyway. So the website sort of aims to showcase probably the best and most luxurious hotel rooms in the world, I would say. And you sort of very, very carefully curate them.
Yes.
So can you just explain how you do that?
So you can't just buy your way in as a hotel into the collection. It is a curated collection. And we want to kind of distance ourselves from the big booking sites that are out there, the 10-ton gorillas in our ring, and really become that kind of niche product so that we're very different and differentiated. And so, yes, from the very beginning, when James and I started the business, it was always about finding those very special places. And yes, we do luxury, but I prefer to call ourselves kind of a boutique brand. Because we do everything from your first date night weekend away in a lovely pub in the countryside, all the way up to the very glamorous city stay. Because also from the very beginning, we realised that as a customer, sometimes you have different needs, you have different modes, you have different budgets. If you just want a quick weekend away just to get out of the city, you know, have some fresh air, you want just a roaring fireplace and some good walks, you know, your budget is not as much for that, but you don't expect to go somewhere where you've got, you know, five-star service and 24-hour room service. That those aren't the things that are important to you. And yet when it's a birthday or anniversary or, you know, that kind of thing, then you will push the boat out. You will have more budget. Exactly the same customer, completely different needs and wants.
Mm. And all your hotels that you discover are then visited by your team anonymously.
Every single one. Our team visit and they tell. So we choose the hotels.
Right.
We go in. The hotels know it's us.
Right.
So we tell them about what we are, how we're different, and we try and see every single room that we can. We really try and get under the skin of the hotel. You know, we get to meet the owner or the GM and really try to understand the product and what they're trying to do.
So you don't
just,
they're
also unique.
You don't just get shown the top suite. You get shown all the rooms under the cupboard, under the stairs and all that sort of stuff as well.
We try and see as much of it as possible. Mm. And then we send an anonymous reviewer. And the hotel is invited into the collection subject to the anonymous review. And that's how we retain, you know, the criteria and make sure that we're...
So in the first instance, they know it's you.
Yes.
And because you explain... exact profile that you're looking for, the types of clients they might expect if they go through you.
Yes.
But then after that, they get visited anonymously
sometime
later, which they don't even know who that is.
Exactly.
And that person goes to stay.
Yes.
You got any jobs going for that?
Absolutely. We're always
sounds like quite a good job,
reviewers.
That, doesn't it? You'd fancy that, Sarah, wouldn't you?
Fantastic. Sign me up.
It's that's the best job.
And you've got a diverse bunch of people that are associated with you. Why is that important? Why have you done that?
Well, even when we were, you know, non-technical before, when we started, you know, James and I didn't come back from a hotelier background. We weren't in the travel industry. We came at it from a consumer angle. We were frustrated. We couldn't find these special places anywhere. They had no voice. And so we thought, you know, who are we to tell you where to spend your precious time away? And so from the very beginning, we used people whose voice you might be interested in, whose opinion you might value.
Such as?
Well, everything from we had a diamond dealer who travelled the world looking for diamonds to, to well-known names. So we've had Kate Blanchett review for us. But everything in between. When we did our Italy guide, we asked one of the head guys at Ferrari to review for us. So it's just interesting people and people whose opinion you might be interested in.
It's like Stella McCartney, Raymond Blanc,
yes.
Tom Dixon. I mean, what do you just do? Ring them up?
Yes. We try and match and there are a smattering of big names in there, but if you look at the reviewer list, there are also, you know, people whose name you wouldn't know, but you understand what they're doing. So there are lots of writers in there, journalists as well, and people who own bars and restaurants. So it's
you sort of know what they're looking at,
exactly.
Yeah.
And we always wanted a mix and not to go too celebrity. Mm. But of course, you know, having that celebrity angle is also gives you lots of benefits.
And these are hotels all around the world, aren't they? They're not just in Europe or whatever. They're literally all around the world.
Yeah, totally global now.
How many are in your collection?
We've got about 1,100.
Right. Okay. So if you spread that across quite a number of countries, they're quite select then, aren't they?
They are. We are very selective. I mean, some cities we have just, you know, one or two hotels. Yeah. And we won't go to a city just because there is, you know, the best of the bunch. We have to have something that's right for our collection. And I think that's to do with kind of customer trust, building customer trust, because the minute we put a hotel on that isn't right, we break that trust with our customer.
Yeah, and reputation is...
everything.
Well, yeah, it's hard to get and easily lost, I think.
Absolutely.
So when you started the business, you were saying you're up against all these other people. So now we've got Expedia, Late Rooms, I don't know, all the different things there. I've got millions, literally, database of millions. And they're not... although you get reviews on there, that doesn't really help you decide where to stay, not really. So how did you move? Because presumably you've got to be online. and actually you must be a tech business in a way.
Yes.
So how, but that you weren't probably to start with. So how did you move into that space? Quite difficult, I should say.
Well, it was a very long time ago. So, and it was in the early days of the internet, I guess. So the first 2 years of our life as a business, we were offline guidebook publishers because that's what you did in the travel industry.
Yeah.
You know, you
wrote a guidebook, print.
Yeah, yeah. And the minute it came off the print run, you know, one of the telephone numbers for the hotels would change and, you know, you'd have to reprint. So those were back in those days.
And through travel agents on the high street and, yes. And through direct mail, so people got them through their letterbox.
Yes. I mean, you know, those days our biggest customer was Waterstones. So Waterstones would buy our books. And but I always wanted, and I'd come from kind of a digital marketing background, and I knew we needed to capture the customer details. And so inside the front of every single book, there was a membership card. And that membership card, you then went to a web page where you would register your details. And that then, when you booked a hotel, would give you something extra. The hotel would give you a glass of champagne or, you know, something nice.
So there's an incentive there for you to build up this mailing list.
And we had an incredible, you know, that mailing list just grew and grew and grew. It was phenomenal how many people, you know, the rate of people signing up. And as the internet became something that people trusted more, and I think in 2005 what changed in the travel industry is people started trusting the big brands with their credit cards. Mm-hmm. I think people like BA, you know, you would trust them with that security. And people were emailing me through the, you know, because we were building this database, and saying, really love your books, really want to book my holiday whilst I'm at work. But if I take my book in, my boss will know that I'm booking my holiday and not working. So please, could you put the hotels online?
Yeah.
So obviously we responded to that. And, you know, the whole industry was changing and going online. And we were very lucky. We, you know, we made that change very early on in 2005.
But how do you keep that stylishness? Because it's, you know, in print is it naturally can be a luxury thing.
Yes.
You know, glossy pages, lovely photographs, you know, big huge photographs. How did you manage to capture that onto a website?
I still think it's very difficult.
And let's see, probably at least half people now are looking at your website on their phone as opposed to a laptop.
Yeah, I mean, that is our toughest job. You know, how do you get a brand across when you haven't got that touchy-feely thing? And that's how we built our brand, by getting the product into people's hands. It was that beautiful guide that we'd spent so much money. I mean, everybody told us we were nuts, that we'd never make any money. And they were probably right on the publishing side. But it's very difficult these days to get that human element across. And the human side of technology is something that fascinates me. You know, how do you keep that human touch? And we're an offline business as well as an online business. So we are very much, you know, our structure is built on technology, but we value actually speaking and meeting with our customers as well, and keeping that interaction with them. So we have a 24/7 travel team who called Smith24, who are there and available to customers. And they go, yeah, the teams are based in London and LA, and they run through the night.
Because the thing is, when you book a holiday, it's very, very expensive. I mean, it's incredibly expensive. I mean, we have some interesting stats here that the team have got together. And what they're saying is that people in the West Midlands, for example, so around Birmingham, are the nation's big holiday spenders, allocating on average £1,000 per person to their summer trip. Now, if you've got a family of four, you know, £3,000 or £4,000, you know, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And therefore, when you go on site, there's nothing worse than spending money, you know, on a holiday and then it's a disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just awful, really.
It's that precious time.
Yeah.
And today we're all working so hard.
Yeah. So it's not just the fact that you feel like you've wasted the money, you know, you come back stressed because it's all gone wrong. Mm. And therefore, trying to build up that trust on a website, it's really important, particularly for holidays, I think, because it's a huge part of your annual budget.
Yeah, it's huge, and it's very important, especially for families to spend that quality time together. Mm. You know, gone are the days when you went on holiday and the kids were just, you know, you just shove them in the kids club because mum actually needed a holiday from the kids because she was, you know, stay-at-home mum.
And your husband.
We're all working
now. And your husband, to be fair. I mean, if there'd have been a husband club, I'd have been right up for that.
Brilliant.
No mind the kids.
I spot a new trend coming along.
Well, they need entertaining.
You heard it here first.
Yeah.
They need entertaining more than the children, let's face it.
Yeah, and all the hoteliers say now it's not about that. It is about providing experiences that the family can do and enjoy together. It's lovely to see hotels really thinking about the family unit properly and making sure that they cater for everyone rather than, you know, mm-hmm. just...
But how do you... I mean, building trust for your brand is really important. And with all due respect to Sandy and our lovely robot there, if you do spend £100 or £150, it might hurt a little bit, but if it all goes wrong, it's not quite so bad. And, yeah. and therefore, sometimes you might make a purchase because it's, okay, I can afford that risk.
Yeah, it's still discretionary, but it's not going to blow your budget for the year.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of money to quite a lot of people. But as you say, it's not such a risk. £3,000 or £4,000 is a risk. So so what are the sort of top tricks and tips that you would sort of advocate for somebody who's in online business where you're asking somebody to spend a lot of money? How do you make people feel secure and that it's not a risk?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, for us, it starts with the curation. So selling the right product is really key to us. And we have metrics to make sure that that product stays good. But then it's down to customer service and really understanding what the customer needs and wants. And our customer service team have a mantra that is leave nothing to chance. So make sure that you've ticked all the boxes and help the customer as much as you can to make that stay really special.
So what you're saying is don't make any assumptions if you work for Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Yeah.
Always check. Yeah. Make sure, you know, everything's done, ticked off.
And never is that more important than when you're talking about family holidays. Mm. Just the little things, from getting the right car seat in the taxi from the airport to your hotel, you know, little things like that. And so we have a concierge team as well who look after, you know, our top customers. And it's leave nothing to chance. And for our concierge team, their mantra is go above and beyond and back again.
Mm. Sarah, what do you book for your family holidays? I do it all myself. So I book I don't leave it to chance. So I book the hotel myself. I book the travel. What do you do? Do you?
Yeah, I'm the same. I have a background in research, so it's always lasted. The fabulous task is put to myself. Yeah, I don't know. I've been a big fan of the likes of, dare I say, Trivago with the last minute kind of options, but actually more and more I've personally become frustrated because it's trying to, as Mara rightly says, find something that ticks a number of different boxes where you know that actually during that time you're going to get the best possible customer service and it's going to come off as a success. Many times when I'm trying to book these holidays, I might do it over a period of 24-48 hours, but really is my mind on it? Not really. I'm just trying to pick the best of a bunch and I'm not really sure if it will or won't work.
I have booked the odd flight for the wrong day. I've turned up to the airport. won't let me through security. And I go, what's the matter? And then realise I should have been there the day before. But because you're rushing and you're doing it in the middle of something else, that's
absolutely
the trouble.
No, well, that's it. And even actually for our honeymoon, I have to say, half of it was a great success and the other half wasn't. Not just
I don't want to know anything about that. Thanks very much. Can you stick to the topic?
But it was the simple fact that in the brochure of the hotels, it said that it was this honeymoon resort, etc. And honestly, by the time that we got there, it really wasn't. Right outside the hotel, it was devastating scenes with poor kids running around naked and
Where's
without
this?
Clothes. And that was in Tasmania.
What did you say?
Somewhere
in Essex or something.
Yeah.
Tasmania? Yeah. I've always heard that Tasmania is a beautiful place.
So, that's why we had chosen it as part of our honeymoon. But unfortunately, we spent a lot of money again. And I only wish it was before I knew tomorrow. I only wish that I'd found her sooner and I would absolutely run to them.
it always fascinates me, you know, that... We talk about robots and taking over everything, but there is still no substitution for being able to speak to a human being who's actually been there before. And I think in travel, you know, it's going to be a long time before any kind of AI can take over.
And maybe it shouldn't.
That kind of recommendation.
Yeah. Maybe it shouldn't.
Yeah, I think it's really important to have both the online and the offline.
Yeah.
And that's what I really love about Mr. and Mrs. Smith, the fact that you've curated it so specially for all your customers, and you've gone to the lengths before, you've done all the research beforehand.
Yeah.
And the fact that you keep up to date with it, that is so important, because not many companies bother. They'll think, okay, we've done that tick box exercise, done. They didn't look
at it. But also, you know, we're talking about lovely holidays, but, you know, when things go wrong, and we're not perfect, right? Things do go wrong, but at least I sleep at night because I know my team is always there for the customer.
Yeah,
we literally are there on the end of the phone 24/7. And that's what I hate about these, you know, huge booking sites, because good luck to anybody trying to get hold of them.
Sometimes you can't, and they deliberately do that so you can't get hold of them. Mm. Well, before we go on to the lovely Robert Simpson, who's been patiently sitting there, can I just ask you tomorrow about Travel Tech Lab?
Yes.
So you're on the advisory board there.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that.
So the Travel Tech Lab is based at the Trampery. And it is encouraging young entrepreneurs to found companies in the travel space, in travel technology in particular, and providing a working environment there for them, and opportunities through partnerships, through large organisations coming in, you know, interested in what these entrepreneurs are doing. And so it's great because I get to see all the kind of new stuff coming through, and I get to help people, which is really lovely in an industry where I think, you know, I have a bit of knowledge and hopefully can help. I think it's a fabulous thing.
And I think people underestimate the usefulness of being either a non-exec or being on an advisory board in terms of your own career development. So whilst you know, you think you're there to help and give a bit of advice and all that sort of thing, for me, being on boards has really helped me see some other things that's actually contributed to my business or to my own development. So, you know, if anybody's out there thinking that somehow it's just about giving your time and being charitable, actually it can be incredibly useful.
I agree with you 100%. It works both ways. And
yeah,
it's lovely where that you have that symbiosis, where you can give something and also learn something from it. Mm. And that's how I feel about the Travel Tech Lab. And there's some fascinating businesses coming through there.
Yeah. You'd advocate people doing that sort of thing, wouldn't you? Especially later on in their career when they've got quite a good bit of knowledge to give back on a board.
Yeah, and I think firstly it's great to be able to disperse that knowledge and advice to others, and we should always be paying it forward. But at the same time, I think the reverse mentoring is equally fascinating. I know many CEOs who have taken in youngsters to come in and spend time with them and provide them with issues for them to address, and these youngsters have come up with some incredible, very simple solutions
that people have missed.
Which people have missed, exactly.
Because they're so simple, probably.
Exactly. You know, I'm a massive advocate for mentoring, and it's extremely, extremely useful. There are a couple of good mentoring sites out there. There's a company called Everlast, which is a recent US company that's come over, and that's a fantastic site to take a peek at if you are thinking about it. But being able to, as you rightly say, jump up into an advisory board position or to explore non-executive positions, I wholeheartedly recommend it.
Yep.
You never know what you're going to learn.
Well, I found them very, very helpful indeed. So, Tamara, thank you very much. And we're just going to have a little break, and then we're going to talk about skateboards. Are you a skateboarder? I'm not.
I'm not.
I wish I was, actually.
I wish I was too.
Yeah,
I know a wonderful young lady who indeed is a big fan and has in fact actually set up her own female skateboarder power troupe here in London. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, so Robert is going to tell us, he's from Slick Revolution. He's going to tell us all about his electric skateboard. They describe themselves as electric skateboard geeks, actually. Is that correct, Robert?
I guess that's true. I don't know what the definition of a geek is, but somebody who's interested
an
in
expert, probably.
An expert in a niche, I guess.
Yeah, an expert in a niche. And you're going to tell us all about electric skateboards. We're going to have a little bit of a break first. And then I believe you've got one with you, have you?
I do, yes. I don't know if the studio is big enough for a try.
Well, we're going to get that out and have a look during the break. So we're just going to have a little break and we'll be back with you in a couple of minutes.
You've joined us at a very good time.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Our savvy software development guys have just qualified for a chunky government cash payout, thanks to our new friends from Breakthrough Funding. Yeah. Sorry, that just slipped out.
Government handout?
No, not a handout, but recognition for our clever thinking. Now it'll be down to you to help us kick it further forward.
Leave it to me.
Your company could qualify for innovation cash too. Find out online now by answering just 6 qualifying questions at breakthroughfunding.com. Yeah!
So we're back in the studio on the Tech Talk show. We're joined by Tamara Lawn from Mr. and Mrs. Smith. We've been talking to Sandy Enoch from Robotical. And now we've got a skateboard turned upside down at the end of the studio. And we're going to talk to Robert Simpson of Slick Revolution. So, Robert, that looks like, albeit a very, very nice skateboard, it looks like a normal skateboard from the top. But you've just flipped it over. What are we seeing there? So it's got the usual four wheels, although they look incredibly smart. And then I presume you've got some sort of electronics or something going on there.
Yes, so the generic industry term is electric skateboards. But in reality, it's the length of a longboard, so almost a metre long.
Yeah.
It's the same as a longboard in respect of the trucks, and it's got a deck, whereas the electric skateboards, they have a battery pack, a controller, and then normally one or two motors mounted onto the rear wheels. It's got a wireless control, so you accelerate and brake. It's got cruise control and a few features.
Cruise control!
My car doesn't have cruise control, but this board does.
Excellent. So basically, if you've got it on the ground and you look at it, it doesn't look any different from a skateboard. A bit longer, perhaps. And so all of those packs are actually stacked underneath the board, so you can't really see them when you're on top of the board. But you've got this lovely handheld device, which is a bit like a TV remote control thing, and you can just stand on it and whiz down the high street on cruise control. Presumably.
Yeah, I mean, the technology's come such a long way since skateboards have been around. Electric skateboards have been around. People were sticking, well, first of all, petrol motors on them, and then lead acid batteries and big chunky things, and quite obviously an electric skateboard.
Mm.
Whereas now lithium-ion batteries have become more affordable and more compact. Electric motors have become, again, more affordable, more compact. And it's really led to this evolution of a design which is relatively discreet in terms of what it can do. I mean, this board, this will take you up to 25 mile an hour, and the range is about 10 miles. So it's a really functional piece of kit, as well as a nice-looking design.
So do people got roads on them? yeah. I mean, you can, because you go fast enough.
There are sort of two ends to the spectrum in terms of electric skateboards. There are the £200 boards you can buy on eBay for kids, which will maybe go 9 mile an hour. And then creeping towards our end is the really functional, slightly more expensive end of the market, where you've got a really functional tool and a big boy's toy, I suppose you could call it. Although we do sell to plenty of women as well.
Yes. But I mean, seriously, people can use that to commute. I mean, you know, because if you're going 20 miles an hour, you're going to get somewhere much quicker, aren't you?
Yeah,
So presumably people don't just use it for, you know, a bit of fun. Actually, some people might be using them every day.
A lot of people email us and say, what's the range? I've got a 3 mile ride to work.
Yeah.
I'm usually running in, jogging in, driving in. I want something a bit different. And that's what it's sort of becoming. It's people are realizing that they are an alternative transport, save you time, save you fuel, and make your morning commute a little bit more interesting.
So the prices of your boards range, I think I've got this right, from £469.99 to just short of £900.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
You've got obviously that top speed you were talking about, but it can climb a 15% gradient.
Yes,
so don't have to get off if there's a hill.
An 80 to 100 kilo rider. The two motors generate a lot of power. And so unless you live in a really hilly area, you won't need to get off and push, basically.
Yeah.
But you can still use it as a normal longboard and push if you run out of juice.
It says multi-terrain. What does that mean?
So this board was really designed for the UK. A lot of the boards out there are just like a lot of extreme sports that come out of California, and they're designed for riding up and down Venice beachfront, perfect tarmac, sun shining, that idyllic scenario. In the UK.
Switch to
UK tarmac, canal towpaths, gravel, twigs, all that kind of thing meant that in this design...
Potholes, particularly at the moment.
Potholes. Yeah. If ever you've ridden a skateboard and even the smallest pebble will lock up your wheel and have you off the front. So this was designed so that we increased the size of the wheel from a typical skateboard has sort of 60mm wheels. This is 110mm diameter. So it's really designed for taking on those rougher terrains. And especially with a board like this, it's called the Flexi Board because the deck of it's flexible. A lot of companies out there are moving towards a solid deck, which means that it's basically cheaper to produce, but you get something called hot feet, which is riding on rougher terrain. Your feet are constantly moving in your shoes and it's quite uncomfortable after a while. So we really went for...
It's a bit like having no suspension on a bike or something.
Exactly. Yeah. It's that same kind of feeling of sort of...
Juddering,
exactly, yeah. A bone shaker. And so this was designed for comfort in mind. Yeah, with the bigger wheels, they've got a convex design and the flexible deck, it all leads to a more comfortable ride. And multi-terrain means it's suitable for smooth tarmac and rough tarmac. You wouldn't take it the same place you would take a mountain bike.
No, obviously not.
But it's that multi-terrain rather than off-road.
Yeah, yeah.
Do people compete with these skateboards?
Not at the moment, but we're hoping to start this year with a bit of a league, if you like. We've got access to a local go-kart track, so we might be doing sort of an evening league racing. At the moment, not a lot of people have heard of them. And so the market's got a lot of room to grow, but hopefully in the future there will be some kind of competition element to them.
Now, the only thing is, if you're a bit of a porker, you can't use them, can you? Because there is a weight limit, apparently. So I'm really sorry, but if you're over 19 stone, you probably can't get on one. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, up to 19 stone accommodates most people who would want to be active or interested in skateboarding. You know,
yeah.
If you weigh over that, you're not going to break the board, but you won't get the same performance as an 80 kilo rider.
You're not going to do 25 miles an hour, are you? You're going to do 4.
Exactly, yeah. That's the reason for the weight limit.
Yeah, I can see that. And I was obviously being flippant, but obviously if you are a pretty big person, then that is going to affect the performance.
Yeah.
So that's good. Okay, so there's a great video of your boards in action, isn't there, on Vimeo? And I presume you can just... Google Slick Revolution to find that video.
Yep, Google Slick Revolution, you'll find us.
Yep, and we'll make sure there's a link from our website. And I know you're trying to develop other sorts of features with it. So what have you got in the sort of planning stage that this skateboard can do?
So this board, the main features which were... It was launched on Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
And the main features which were developed and we paid for moulds for were the rough stuff wheels. And then the flexible battery case. We segmented the battery into sections, which allows for it to have that flexibility. Moving into the future, we're looking to have possibly moving to lithium ion polymer batteries. We're looking to redesign it slightly in terms of a extended battery pack. And then we've got a new remote controller on the way, which will have feedback in terms of the battery percentage, speed, range, that kind of thing. Where we fit into the market, we don't have a fancy app like some of the boards, but that's why we can keep our price below £1,000 for our top end boards. A lot of people want the app, but then again, doing a bit of market research, it's sort of it's not worth our investment into an app.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Maybe it's something for the Travel Tech Hub.
Yeah, you need to think about that tomorrow. And you need to get those guys to have a look at this stuff. It's fantastic, isn't it?
It is amazing, yeah. My son would kill for this.
Yeah, absolutely kill. So if anybody wants to find out about these boards, they need to go on to slickrevolution.co.uk.
Slickrevolution, yeah.
.co.uk. Co.uk. Have a good look at that. But I know that you're working on other stuff as well, Robert. So you are designing backpacks for skateboards.
In a way, yes. I mean, I have a new business which launched off the back of this business, and it's an invention of mine called Deck Hook. Deck referring to the deck of a skateboard or a longboard or an electric skateboard. That, again, launched on Kickstarter. I don't think there's any other place you could launch a new product nowadays. And then we've just filed for a patent for that. In fact, it's a small metal device. It clips onto a rucksack, and it means that you can hang the trucks of the board onto that, and it means that you can carry any board on any backpack. That came out of filming. We were filming some stuff in London, carrying the boards around all day. I mean, they're not heavy, but they're not light. This one weighs about 8.5 kilos. So carrying it round in places on the tube, that kind of thing, it became a bit tiresome. And so it really came out of necessity. And that launched in the US on Kickstarter, and that raised just under $57,000 to go into production.
Very good. So yeah,
I can tell you, as mother of a skateboard fanatic, and I'm the one that ends up carrying the damn skateboards everywhere, that is a super useful tool. Thanks.
Yeah. No problem.
Yeah. And what do you think of the future of these types of things? You know, I am seeing the odd middle-aged person, actually, on a little scooter occasionally, but also skateboards, rollerblades. Do you think people are going to be using these more and more?
Yeah, I mean, we've got sort of three demographics. We've got 40-year-old blokes, typically, with some excess cash who want a bit of fun. Maybe they were a skateboarder in their teens, that kind of thing. We've got mums buying for young teenagers, normally nagging young teenagers. And then we've got sort of people like myself, 25, gadget-minded, watch people on YouTube, fans of drones, all that kind of thing. The future of them, I think that personal electric transport will creep more and more into our lives. Cities are becoming more polluted. Cars are being banned in the not-so-distant future. Electric vehicles are on the way. And so I can only see that they become a bigger part of everyday life for people, particularly in cities, really.
I mean, I do think there's going to be these self-driving cars, don't you, Sarah? I mean, it's going to be a huge thing. I think the days of you being able to drive a car and do what you want are going to be numbered,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, in some ways I think it will probably be safer in some instances. But I'm also really keen, just seeing the skateboard, I'm thinking, when's the hoverboard being released?
We're working on that at the moment.
Excellent.
Good. Until we have a billion-dollar investment, I don't know how far it'll go, to be honest. Mm.
But I do think, though, that if we're going to be driving less, and you know, because people who control our town centres are going to say we're not going to allow people to drive anymore, you either have these self-driving cars, you know, and it's all narrowed down, and you do this, that, and the other. But I think that then people will want to. People like speed. People want to be in control of things, and I think it might mean that people are more inclined to use these sorts of things because that's where your enjoyment's going to come. Your freedom's going to come, if you know what I mean.
I think so. I think a lot of people, they either use them for commuting or going for a blast up and down the seafront on a weekend. You know, it's adding that enjoyment factor to. It's a bit like you buy a car, you buy a Jaguar, and the advert for the Jaguar is the guy cruising along the beachfront, whereas in reality, most people who are sat in traffic
of 5 miles,
listening to radio, you know, it's that image of what you want people want to be. And I think that'll, I think it's that whole sort of electric transport revolution of people taking back control and using a technology they've never used before, really.
I also think I'd be embarrassed, you know, because I'm older and I'd look a bit silly, but actually I think that embarrassment's going. I think because more and more people are doing it, people go, actually, I can't fancy that myself. I would really genuinely like to have a little scooter along the high street. I'm really happy doing that, but I'm not, I don't know.
So Bay 66, which is a huge skate park under the Westway in London, they do an old-timers night.
Thanks for that, Tamara.
For people who, you know, want to take it a bit more gently, you know, who perhaps were skateboarders.
I don't want to do it gently. I want to be really bad. I want to really go for it. I want to run over as many people as I can. Sandy, have you got any thoughts on this type of, in terms of, can you see robotics having an impact on this sort of transport?
Interesting. Well, I mean, obviously, self-driving cars you were talking about, those are robots, basically. So lots of thoughts on those. I think this personal electric transport, though, is it's a great shame it hasn't already got bigger. I mean, the Segway came along, and that was going to revolutionize things. And then there was some issues with, you know, is it road legal, is it not? And then it never really took off like I was kind of hoping it would. I was also thinking about getting myself an electric scooter for my commute recently.
I really decided not to.
It does look fun. And this also looks fun. And maybe this, you know, looks a bit less naff than the electric scooter. I don't know. But I think
those Segways looked so naff, though, didn't they?
They looked dangerous to me.
As long as they're turned on, it's difficult to fall off, I think. I've never actually been on one, but they're self-balancing. I mean, they're clever machines. But I think you're right that this kind of will more people commuting on this. It'll take the pressure off the roads. It's more fun. And once it becomes
sort of adopted by more and more people, other people go, well, actually, I don't feel quite so stupid now because loads of people are doing it. So you get a tipping point, don't you, really? You need to make sure that tipping point happens, Robert. That's the thing.
I hope so. Yeah. I think it's perhaps maybe a few years behind sort of the electric bike revolution. A lot of people who now have electric bikes perhaps weren't cyclists before. A lot of people who have them are slightly older and they want to keep up with their local cycling team. And so they get an electric bike and they're still able to do that. And it's not as a difficult chore riding to work on an electric bike as a normal bike. And so it's really opened up the market to a lot of people who wouldn't have necessarily considered that method of transport before.
They're blooming expensive, though. I mean, electric bikes, they are hugely expensive. Whereas you're talking there for £400 to £800, you know, that's much more achievable, isn't it?
It's true. But then again, if you're spending, I'm not sure how much an annual tube pass is, but
true.
You know, if you're taking sort of saving £5-10 a day, perhaps, you know, it soon adds up and you keep fit at the same time.
Yeah, and far less dangerous than a Boris bike. So we're just coming to the end of our show. Final thoughts on skateboarding? Can we tempt you? Sarah?
I'm really excited about it. The only thing is I can just see myself going derriere down. I'd need a proper padding suit. But no, I think it's really, really exciting. And if we could have skater lanes.
That would be a good idea, especially at Oxford Street. That would be good. So I'd like to thank my three guests today. And first of all, Tamara Lawn, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. If you want to find out more about Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you never guess what. The website is MrAndMrsSmith.com.
And there's, thank you for having
and it's
me.
Beautiful. So have a good look. And it will take the risk out of you planning a holiday and going somewhere very special. So have a good look on that. And thank you to Robert Simpson, Slick Revolution, and those amazing skateboards. And if you're interested in that, slickrevolution.co.uk. We'll put all those links on our website. And then to Sandy. Thank you, Sandy Enoch. Robotical.
Robotical.io. Or if you search for Marty the Robot.
Do a quick Google for Marty the Robot. And you've got to watch it. He's adorable, isn't he?
He's just too cute.
Yeah, too cute.
We get quite attached to them, actually. It's a bit of a problem watching them go.
I can imagine. Really, really good. So you've been listening to the Tech Talk Show. We're now syndicated to dozens of radio stations across the UK and further afield. And thank you to my fellow presenter, Sarah Luxford of Tech London Advocates. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Sue.
You're going to see if you can afford a Mr. and Mrs. Smith, aren't you?
Oh, I'm going to get online after this.
Yeah, I might do as well. And if you want to recommend any future guests, someone doing something groundbreaking in the tech sector, please get in touch with us via Twitter on @TechTalkShow.UK, or if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, go to techtalkshow.co.uk. And I hope you have a good week. Bye now.